Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. The date is March 3rd, 2015, and we're bringing you episode 49 tonight. And I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
Yes. We're the ones who bring you this. And you know what I was just thinking as that introduction music was playing, how much I love both the intro and the outro for this show and how I'm going to miss hearing it when we don't do the show any longer. Of course, I could always listen to some episodes, but I will miss it because it just puts me in a good space as soon as it starts playing. Well, we might have a lot to talk about tonight, and so we probably better get started. We're still on August 16th, and I gave the timeline for August 16th last week when we had the afternoon part of it. So time for you to just get us going here.
We'll just take off with it. 16th of August, 1942, evening. Britain prepares for war. Hats off to the French worker. Wehrmacht estimates. My struggle for success. Obstruction by Wehrmacht chiefs and shocked. Absorbing the unemployed. Conscription once more. Germany can tolerate even me. Churchill and his friends decided on war against us some years before 1939. I had this information from Lady Mitford. She and her sisters were very much in the know thanks to their relationship with influential people. One day she suddenly exclaimed that in the whole of London there were only 3 anti-aircraft guns. Her sister, who was present, stared at her stonily and then said slowly, "I do not know whether Mosley is the right man, or even if he is in a position to prevent a war between Britain and Germany."
Well, let's stop here.
That's a good idea.
Because he's going to talk about conscription in Britain, but that's a totally different kind of topic. And, you know, this is just sort of leads you to want more about what he's talking about. And before the show, actually, I looked up Unity Mitford, and that's the one he's talking about. She's the one who, of those 5 sisters, who was most enamored of Hitler and the one who shot herself in the head in 1939 when Britain declared war on Germany because she was so upset that the 2 countries that she loved were going to be at war together. And up until then, she was spending, eventually all of her time in Germany. She was just absolutely head over heels over Adolf Hitler for several years. And he finally, there's some interesting stories about that. He finally brought her into his circle after she was hanging around for a couple of years, you know, just following him around practically, stalking him. And what she said here, it was not, he said he's talking about 1939, but this information had to have been probably a couple of years at least before 1939. That she said this.
What that whole thing took me back to, Carolyn, was my friendship with Tyler Kent. And there was a circle of powerful British politicians and whatever people who wanted at all costs to avoid a war with Germany.
To avoid
because
one?
They correctly
oh, yeah,
saw it.
Yeah,
yeah, to avoid
right.
one.
Yeah, yeah.
And now Oswald Mosley and his, I think it was called the Black Shirts or Silver Shirts, but they were openly, National Socialists, and there were other high-level people who were very, very disturbed that Churchill Chamberlain was being pushed to aggravate and try to start something with Germany. Churchill, behind the scenes, he was the guy that was really pushing for war, and he had been doing that, and that's why this opening sentence, he says, Churchill and his friends decided on war against us some years before 1939. And so it was to try to get Germany into a war, and all of it was, of course, about economics. They were afraid of the competition in the markets of the world, and they knew Germany was a very, very qualified competitor. So and then there were demonstrations by Mosley and his group, you know, to try to keep people out of the deal. And over here, of course, it was America First Committee led by Charles Lindbergh and a couple of American senators. But those were the people very opposed to getting a war into a war. And
well,
that's,
now here's
that's
the thing,
the,
though. As you say that, this sister that he's talking about has to be Diana, and she's the one who married Mosley, and she actually left her husband that she was married to, and it was in 1932. Started, went off on this affair with Oswald Mosley, and then the Unity got involved, you know, got impressed with the Germans too. So there was just these two sisters out of the five, I think, that were involved and were in Germany.
Yes. Yeah.
But he's saying like that Unity was speaking of something that there's only three anti-aircraft guns in London, and her sister was looking stonily at her like she said something she shouldn't have said.
Yes.
Because we don't know when this was, but she might have been, you know, they were kind of torn between Britain and Germany. And I was just wondering if this meant that there were three anti-aircraft guns in London was more than you would have before 1939, or whether that was revealing that there wasn't any enough there and they weren't prepared for war.
That was
or
it.
You think so?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that was my first impression. And then I started thinking about it more and saying, well, it wasn't really made clear. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for them.
Okay. We'll move on. Once conscription was introduced into Britain, the die was cast, and not in our favor. Happily, the rascals had not the patience to wait. If they had held on for 3 or 4 years, they would have had an army of 30 or 40 divisions, which they could have sent to Europe.
Okay, well, I looked up British conscription before the show, too, and the limited conscription was introduced by Chamberlain on 27 April 1939. That's what he's talking about, I suppose, that they started subscription.
That's right.
Conscription. It wasn't full conscription. It was a 2-year stint for young men, and they're in a kind of a militia. They didn't want to show that they were trying to, you know, prepare.
Preparing.
And then on 3rd September 1939, when after war was declared, the Military Training Act was overtaken by the National Service Act, and in this one, the first intake was absorbed into the Army. So they're actually drafting people for the Army then, but before they were trying to kind of cover it up. So again, he's saying once conscription was introduced, the die was cast. Well, that was a limited conscription, but still in all, it was a conscription. And it was in April of 39. So that's what he's referring to.
Okay.
I would say.
The French workman is an exceptionally skilled craftsman. Their factories and machinery are certainly out of date, but the workmanship is first class, and they carry out repairs with incredible rapidity. We, I think, lose a great deal of time by working so slowly on repairing damage. As regards rearmament, it was my principle to outline the plan for 1 year at a time. For a man invariably rises to the occasion that circumstances impose on him. For the year 1933-34, I allotted 3 milliard marks to the Wehrmacht. For 1934-35, the amount rose to 5 milliards, and by the time war was declared, 92 milliard marks had been expended on the armed forces. Such figures are wholly without precedent. Before the first war, the defense budget called for about 1 milliard.
And now, as we said before, a milliard is a billion. So the first war, they had $1 billion for the whole war, or the whole defense budget.
And that was before the war, see, and what he's saying right there, that was not a whole lot of preparation.
Right, right.
For World War One. No one can say that he was prevented from carrying out a task of national importance by lack of funds. The Reichstag was never consulted on the subject of money. The decision on what was to be done and what was not to be done was mine and mine alone. From the moment that I abandoned the gold standard, and while I still had large numbers of unemployed at my disposal, I had no financial problems. I had to support 7 million whole-time and 4 million part-time unemployed. This necessitated a budget of 5 milliards. We should have saved many milliards of overseas expenditure if the Wehrmacht had from the beginning been content to accept our own synthetic and supplementary raw materials instead of insisting on importing from abroad. I declared that we must put our economy on a war footing, but the Wehrmacht refused to follow my lead until compelled to do so by the pressure of war. You would not believe the lengths to which they went in order to thwart me. When I called for the construction of warships, they retorted by demanding copper to the tune of 1/8 of the annual production of the whole world. When the First World War started, we had at our disposal the accumulated reserves of 30 years, but in 1939 we had nothing. I cannot tell you with what fury and anger I had to work in order to get what I wanted. Even with good old Fritsch, I had a battle royal on the day I reintroduced conscription. 36 divisions will be raised, I ordered, and don't think you can turn me from my purpose by telling me that we have not the requisite arms and equipment. The Fuhrer turns to Jodl. You say you had to fight tooth and nail for every single thing, and that even so, you were frequently compelled to reduce your demands by 40%, 60%, and even as much as 80%. Well, you can thank Blomberg for that. I had nothing to do with it. To the Wehrmacht, I allotted more in money and kind than it could possibly make use of. Again and again, I had to protest that such and such an order had not been passed on, and quarrels on this subject were a weekly event. The invariable reply given to me was, "The Wehrmacht doesn't want it." There was a mass of people working against me behind my back and systematically sabotaging my efforts. And yet, what on earth did it matter if expenditure exceeded the budgetary estimate? The Air Force regularly overspent about 2 milliards annually. A crisis could only have...
I've got some commentary here, which I think just fits in right here. And it is that now Blomberg, who he's blaming for Jodl's problems, was commander-in-chief of German armed forces until January 1938. He was talking about from the time he took office in 1933 and what he was trying to accomplish. And then in my looking things up, I found that according to some sources, Hindenburg was the one who actually forced the Night of the Long Knives onto Hitler, because he wanted to clean out. They didn't like the SA, you know, and they didn't want problems between the SA and the Wehrmacht, or the Reichswehr at the time, maybe it was. And then in 1934, after Hindenburg's death, Blomberg personally ordered all soldiers in the Army and all sailors in the Navy to pledge the Reichswehr the oath of allegiance of the Reichswehr, not to people and fatherland, as it had been, but to the new Führer, Adolf Hitler, which is thought to have limited later opposition to Hitler. The oath was the initiative of Blomberg and that of the Minister's Department Chief General Walter von Reichenau. The entire military took an oath of personal loyalty to Hitler, who was most surprised at the offer, says here. The popular view that Hitler imposed the oath on the military is incorrect, and this is a number of historians. The intention of Blomberg and Reichenau in having the military swear an oath to Hitler was to create a personal special bond between Hitler and the military, and was intended to tie Hitler more tightly towards the military and away from the Nazi Party. Blomberg later admitted that he did not think through the full implications of the oath at the time. So that was why the Army, and I figured that that was part of Hitler's thing, but according to this, no, it was not. Yeah. He didn't demand that they swear an oath to him, but he didn't mind it either, so that's what happened. And then this fact that the military was so reluctant to even take this money that he wanted to give them to prepare the way he wanted them to prepare. Some background on that: on 5th November 1937, the conference between the Reich's top military foreign policy leadership and Hitler was recorded in the so-called Hossbach Memorandum, H-O-S-S-B-A-C-H. And I've heard of that, but I was not real clear what that referred to. But the Hossbach Memorandum is the record of this conference in which Hitler stated that it was time for wars as what Hitler envisioned were a series of localized wars in Central and Eastern Europe in the near future. He argued that these wars are necessary to provide Germany with Lebensraum, or Lebensraum, so therefore autarky, or that, you know, self-sufficiency and the arms race with France and Britain made it imperative to act before the Western powers developed an insurmountable lead in the arms race. Of those invited to the conference, objections arose from the foreign minister Konstantin von Neurath, Blomberg, and the army commander-in-chief General Werner von Fritsch. And he mentions all these people here, you know, who were in his way and not cooperating like he thought they should. They were objecting to it, that any German aggression in Eastern Europe was bound to trigger a war with France because of the French alliance system in Eastern Europe, the so-called cordon sanitaire. And if a Franco-German war broke out, then Britain was almost certain to intervene rather than risk the prospect of France's defeat. Moreover, it was objected that Hitler's assumption that Britain and France would just ignore the projected wars because they had started their rearmament later than Germany was flawed. They thought Hitler's thinking was flawed, and so they were reluctant. But this was the thinking behind it all. So you can see what he was doing then was doing everything he could to push his own ideas through. And he says that, too. And he did, of course, manage to do it. So,
well, he was far-seeing, as you well know. And he was looking down the road and the way things were going with England, France, you know, the agitators for war against Germany and the Jewish pressure and all that stuff. And he could see that Germany better produce as many guns and bullets as they could because they were going to be needed in great numbers and sooner than these people would want it to be to happen.
Yeah, as is pointed out here, though, also, and I think it's true, he was wanting at that time Lebensraum. He was wanting to expand Germany
space
as much as he could because Germans didn't have the have what they needed. You know, they needed to go into more territory, so they had more of what they needed. They had been, you know, reduced by the First World War results.
Versailles Treaty, yeah.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that was his idea, and he wanted to go ahead and do it while before the British and French got stronger and would really stop him. So the military were a lot more cautious and weren't sure they wanted to ever take on. They didn't really want to go to war, you know. Of course, militaries are not necessarily good if they just want to go to war all the time. That's not the purpose of having a military. But there was just dragging them along behind him, and he had the energy. He must have expended tons and tons of energy, which had to have affected his health too. You know that.
And the countries, of course, at the end of World War One, that seized German territory were Poland and then the creation of that artificial or new nation called Czechoslovakia. A lot of that was German land and territory.
Right.
And excuse me. And when Hitler talked about expanding and what they needed, the first thing was to take back what had been taken from them. And that's why I think the talk about earlier about these wars are going to be occurring here, limited small wars, whether in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
that's what he was referring to. And if there's opposition to that, if Poland says, no, we're not giving back the corridor or anything else, and Danzig. And so I think that's what he was referring to. And you're right, he wanted to settle all of that before Britain and France could do actually what they wound up doing.
Right.
Okay. He says, a crisis could only have arisen after all the unemployed labor had been absorbed, and this did not happen until late 1937 or early 1938. Up till then, the only difficulties we had to face were those of foreign exchange. Schacht had told me that we had at our disposal a credit of 1,500 million marks abroad, and it was on this basis that I planned my four-year plan, which never caused me the slightest anxiety. Goring, by the way, was given very wide powers in this field, and that is how things are today, and we never find ourselves blocked for want of money. I always protested against the homeopathic-like quantities which the Wehrmacht demanded. The industrialists were always complaining to me about this niggardly procedure. Today, an order for 10 howitzers. Tomorrow, for 2 mortars, and so on. And that when one knows that production lines require 4 to 8 months before they can set to work. In the end, I had to step in and order mass production, and mass production without limit. Had it not been for these restrictive practices, our Navy would today have had 4 more battleships than it actually possesses. Craftsmen, steel, we had everything we needed. My political economy has always been aimed at obtaining the maximum return for expenditure. I have invariably been opposed to certain practices, as, for instance, the financing of a factory destined to produce material for the Wehrmacht. The four-year plan made such practices impossible, for under it, the money voted to the Wehrmacht had to be spent exclusively on the purchase of material. To give an order for 500,000 haversacks, and then to advance to industry the money to build a factory for their manufacture, is sheer stupidity. As for the Navy, they never once made any demands on their own behalf. It was always I who had to do it for them, and then, if you please, the Navy themselves would whittle down the program I proposed for them. The Army were no better. Here again, it was I who had to urge the adoption of a program of real expansion. And it was the Army which countered with hesitancy and evasions. I was so frustrated that in the end I was compelled to withdraw their prerogatives from the Army and assume them myself. I can give you dozens of examples. The best one is the West Wall itself, and then Helgoland. The Navy declared that defenses there were quite unnecessary, and it was only when war had been actually declared that they agreed to the fortification of the island. Tanks, I was told, were of no value unless they were both light and fast. Again, after a hard struggle, I imposed my will and ordered the manufacture of heavy tanks. I ordered the installation of wired wireless throughout Germany. The Ministry of Propaganda evaded the execution of my order on the grounds that the Ministry of Posts and Telegraph had declared that the project was not yet technically sufficiently advanced. But the ministry had never suffered from lack of funds with which to perfect the technique.
Now, this is what he was talking about before on a previous occasion, that Goebbels is responsible for. Goebbels just let it drop because I guess now he says this other ministry said it wasn't technically advanced enough, so he just let it, he didn't push it through. And Hitler's still a little bit upset about this because it was needed later, and then they didn't have it for that reason. There's an example of one thing that he was right and others were wrong, and he's probably right about all of it.
Right. Before the war, when I saw that the Army could not be induced to take any steps as regards motorization, I went myself to Krupps and arranged that the SS units should be equipped with Panzer Mark IV. Hardly had war been declared when the Army shrieked to high heaven that these tanks be allotted to them. Immediately after the reintroduction of conscription in 1936, I demanded that the whole country should forthwith be put in a state of defense. The negative results were puerile. The Army, it is true, submitted a scheme to be spread over several years and to be completed in 1952, the net result of which would have been the construction of a few strong points. There was no question of any lack of funds. It was just that the general staff wanted it that way. So it was that I was always compelled to use my overriding powers to get my own way. It is much the same now, but now there's no excuse. We have a Reich war minister whose sole duty it is to come to me and say, "We require this and that." It was for this sole purpose that he was appointed. During all these years, I have never allowed the slightest discussion with the finance branch. I have never had a conference with Schacht to discover what means were at our disposal. I restricted myself to saying simply, "This is what I require, and this is what I must have." I would add, has the mark so far suffered any harm? Is it not retaining its full value, thanks to the authority of the state and its economic principles? You are not here to tell me that such and such a project is impracticable. Your job is to provide me with the means to make it practicable. Schacht always opposed me on principle. His negative attitude produced so devastating an effect on his audience that on one occasion at the end of a conference, Stulpnagel cried, "Poor old Germany." I was more of a match for Herr Schacht. These financiers seem to have no idea of the real efficiency of our economic principles. One day, when Krosick came to me full of questions, I said to him, "My dear Herr Krosick, you are quite wrong. The thing has got to be done. No state has ever gone bankrupt for economic reasons, but only as the result of losing a war." The most able of our financiers was my party colleague Reinhardt. His estimate of our revenue from income tax was most accurate, and thanks to him, we were able to raise our revenue from this source from 5 milliards to 80 milliards without increasing the cost of living and without suffering any of the devaluation which one sees in other countries. My attention was recently drawn to the fact that all the laws which we submit are systematically rejected by three ministers, Schacht, Stanislaus, and Neurath. The rest are always in agreement. And the infuriating thing is that most of these laws are no concern of the ministers mentioned, who in any case are not members of the cabinet. The best method is always to settle a thing directly with the minister concerned, and thus avoid tedious discussion in which one will argue from the legal point of view while another quotes principles of financial orthodoxy. That sort of thing drives me to fury. One day I said to one of these gentlemen, "The German nation has survived the period of the great migrations, the wars with the Romans, the onslaughts of the Huns, the Magyars and the Mongols, the 30 Years' War, the campaigns of Frederick the Great and Napoleon, and it will no doubt survive even my rule." Well, you know, that this little section here shows that monolithic picture people have in their mind of the National Socialist government, Hitler issuing orders and they be carried out immediately without question, things like this. You know, he had the same problem with bureaucrats as every country does, and people who doubt, people who are afraid and don't want to take responsibility, things like that. And boy, he unloads here on them, and I'm so glad he talked about the German financial system, because to me that was the fuse that lit the war, was when Germany took control of the German money supply, took the Reichsbank and put it back into the control of the Germans and the German nation, and took it out of the hands of the international bankers, most of whom were Jews. And because they declared themselves off the gold standard, and their money was backed by the German state itself and the work of the German laborer rather than a stack of gold, that's why when he says here, "I didn't have any problems with money," they could say, "Well, we're over budget, whatever." He said, "What the hell? Get the job done." And then he says a second ago here about, has the mark suffered because of my policies? No, it has not. There's been no devaluation. That was what autarky was all about. And the German effort here, you know, they weren't going into tons and tons of debt to an individual bunch of bankers by having to fight this war. And, of course, that's one reason they had to break Germany totally, because if the rest of the world got a view of what was really happening economically and how Germany had freed itself from the grip of these people, they might have just thought, have had second thoughts. But I enjoyed this part of the essay here.
Yeah. Well, I liked this particular part very much. And this is the one we were waiting to read since last week.
Right.
But, you know, the difference between National Socialism and the other system is that National Socialism is based on national values or, you know, real values. And
that's
the
right.
other system is based on money or, as you said, gold. And that's it. And people are encouraged, as we are now in all of our formerly white countries, we're encouraged to think that money solves everything and that what we want most of all is money. You know, money is the highest good. And
reason
that's,
for living.
Yeah, and that's totally not the case in real national socialism.
Right.
So that's a really important point. Now, this Reinhardt that he mentioned as his colleague, Reinhardt with it ending with DT, which is the name of the camps, the Reinhardt camps that they call them, of the Sobibor, Belzec, and Treblinka, supposedly named after Reinhard Heydrich. Can you imagine naming a program after somebody's first name in Germany? Well, it was actually named after the Reinhard plan or whatever was named after this financial guy, this one of the party financiers, and he was very excellent. But you know, Carlo Mattonio says that the Operation Reinhardt was named after Reinhard Heydrich because it fits in to what he thinks shows that the reason for deporting the Jews was not to execute them in gas chambers, but for other reasons. And so he goes along with that, but I don't think that there can be any real evidence for that, and a lot of other people don't either. So I just thought of that when this came up here.
Right.
Hitler saw this man as important in his administration, and he was, and this whole thing that they called Operation Reinhardt was named after him because it was about collecting the goods and turning them over to the Reich, and, you know, they were all going to belong, the goods of the Jews were going to belong to the Reich, nobody was allowed to take anything from any of it for their personal embellishment. They had to, you know,
right.
That was a very highly criminalized if they did that. So that's what that operation was all about. It wasn't about sending people to these so-called killing centers, you know, close to the Russian border. Well, that was a real good section, and we've got more good sections coming up. So let's go ahead.
We got 16th of August, 1942, An Invention of the Lawyers, Sabotaging the Nation's Morale. Major Engel reported that at Königsberg Airport, one of the port officials had seized from a plane some foodstuffs brought in by the pilots and destined for the black market. The Führer was very angry and said, "That is the sort of thing which one would expect from enemies of the state and which would infuriate our soldiers beyond all control if they knew of it." So that's the thanks they get from the home front. Sabotage of the people's will to resist. I'll get to the bottom of this affair. I don't care whether the culprit is in the Wehrmacht or the customs. I'll have him in prison, and I shall employ the utmost savagery to put an end to such practices. What can one bring back from the East? Works of art? There are none. Only odds and ends of food, and one cannot do better than distribute that among German families. It is perfectly true that the soldier lives better at the front than he does at home on leave. The instigator of this sorry practice is without doubt a lawyer, probably the Minister of Finance himself. What a pity Bormann was not there.
You know, this really says a whole lot. It's really interesting.
Yes, it does.
It must have been, the previous one was 16th of August at dinner, so this must have been later that night. He was talking a little bit more. this idea that, you know, if some soldiers wanted to fly in some food, that he thinks they should have been allowed to do so without it, some bureaucrat in the Port Authority taking it from them and then doing who knows what with it. So what he says, you know, he's just furious. He's going to, well, he used the word savage. He's going to get to the bottom of it by employing the utmost savagery to put an end to such practices. And when he talks about soldiers wanting to bring food for their families, when he says that the soldiers have it better than the people back home, this is something that Leopold Wenger brought out a few times in his letters home when he said to his family, his parents, you know, that he was so sorry, he felt so bad that they had so little good things to eat. He didn't say it that way, whatever word to use, but that they were, you know, suffering from lack, so much lack, and that he had more than they did, and he felt so bad for them, he wished he could help them out, you know, and so a lot of these, they did try to do that, and there was nothing wrong with it. And then when Hitler says, "What a pity Bormann was not there," it shows that Hitler knew Bormann was of one mind with him on most things, you know, and he could rely on Bormann. And if Bormann was there, he would have done something about it.
Yeah, and you know, it's I had to look this over a couple of times to try to understand exactly what was happening here, because you could interpret it a couple of ways. And the plane comes in with foodstuffs. Okay, it lands at Königsberg Airport, and it's probably destined for the front. And this port official seized some of it.
Well, I thought it was going the other way. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well,
I was thinking
that's what I mean.
Back.
There were two ways to take it, and it says brought in by the pilots and destined for the black market. And so did the port official seize that to keep it from going to the black market, or did he take it to make sure it got to the black market instead of to the front? And so, to me, it was a bit difficult to figure, but...
I think that Hitler might have been thinking that the black market was not something to worry about too much, because if there was food available to the people and they were able to find it on, you know, apart from their rations, that you know, he was not against them being able to do that. That's another way.
Well,
you know,
there were obviously restrictions back home on the home front, the people having to do without things, and that the soldiers were able to get at the front. And so somebody says, "Hey, we can make a bundle here. This plane is coming in. Let's take this shipment and black market it back to these cities and sell it for a little profit for ourselves here." And
they were able to make a profit on that. I don't think that you're talking about.
Oh, well, anything they sold it for was profit.
Well, yeah, but I don't think the Fuhrer would have approved of that.
No, absolutely not. And that's why his anger is this foodstuffs were to be delivered to the guys at the front. I mean, that's the way I took it.
Okay.
And somebody says, "Hey, let's grab this that's intended for the fighting men up the front, and let's take it and deal with it and sell it under the table to people where there are restrictions applied and it's hard to get this stuff, and we'll just make a bundle on it." I mean, and that's a normal black market operation.
Well, that's
and that's kind of how I interpreted that, yeah.
I guess because I was aware of what Wenger wrote, and that Hitler does say it's perfectly true that the soldier lives better at the front than he does at home on leave, because there are even letters from others in his letters, you know, talking about that he had some when some buddy of his or, you know, comrade of his was home on leave, and he would write to Poldi and said, "Can you send this or that to my family here? Because, boy, they don't have much of anything to eat. We don't have anything to eat here," you know? And so that's the way they did. They did try to supply some things back to the home front when they were able to. So that's probably why I took it that way. But I can see what you're saying, and you might very likely be right, very likely.
Well, the important thing was his reaction and his anger. And when he says, I wish Borman would have been there to handle it, because he, like you said, he knew Borman would have handled it exactly as he would, right on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Okay,
well,
shall we move on?
This time, I've been thinking, Ray, that already I notice that sometimes we don't understand what's going on, already since Haim has come back. And we understood better with the other guy because he made sure that certain things were put in. And this is a real failing of Heinrich Haim for just putting these things in here without enough explanation or indication even, just some indication of what the heck he's talking about.
Yeah,
right.
You know, we just have to interpret it the best we can, you know, and
and
I think together we can get it pretty much the way it should have been. Ready to go to 20th of August.
Oh, yeah, I've got a lot of timeline for 20th of August. On the 17th, the 1st U.S. Army Air Force's B-17 heavy bomber raid in Europe targeted Sotteville Railroad Yards in Rouen, France. So they are bombing in France to start. On the 18th, Japanese reinforced New Guinea. Australians land troops at Port Moresby. Meanwhile, American planes have destroyed Japanese air power at Wewak, New Guinea. And New Guinea, I had to look it up. It's a large island above Australia. I was studying that area there. Boy, it's hard for me to keep straight. And then on the 19th, Operation Jubilee was a raid by British and Canadian forces on Dieppe, France, that famous one that ends in disaster.
Yeah.
They come under heavy gunfire, and eventually most are killed or captured by the German defenders. And this is one I am familiar with because Poldy Wenger played a role in that. Keep talking about Poldy tonight. And he wrote about it. And I just figured I'd say that the final toll, as far as I could make out, was 1,794 Allied killed and 311 Germans killed. That was a real disaster for the Allies. And, you know, we were talking about how they wanted to make a landing, and they felt they couldn't do it. And so then the British, mostly the British and the Canadians, did this mostly kind of as a test. That's what they said. They were just testing things out, and the test failed. But maybe that was why they did that particular ploy. And then on the 20th, Henderson Field on Guadalcanal receives its first American fighter planes. I don't know anything about Henderson Field. Do you?
Yeah, I mean, it was built there to enable American forces airplanes for a place to stop, refuel, and get them closer to, as they march through the islands toward Japan, through Japanese-held territory. It was a jumping-off point that got them closer to their objective.
Yeah, because Guadalcanal was further to the east from Australia, wasn't it? A little bit to the east of Australia, where New Guinea was right there above it. Yeah, northeast. It was a smaller, much smaller little island.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay, 20th of August, 1942, midday, special guests, Dr. Lammers, Dr. Tirak, and Dr. Rodenberger. Crimes, big and little.
You know, let me just say here I go again, but let me just say who these people are, because it's kind of important since he's talking about legal system in Germany and so on, and they are all jurists. Lammers was the manager of his chancellery, but he used to be a jurist. He's a former jurist. And Rottenberger was one of the defendants at the judge's trial where he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. Well, he was a jurist. He was a prominent judicial reformist in Germany, and he sent his ideas about reform to Hans Lammers, who's here too. And in early 1941, Lammers was not impressed and rejected the plan. Rothenberger then, Lammers was higher than he was. Rothenberger then sent the same ideas to Rudolf Hess, who proved keener but made his ill-fated flight to Scotland before he could act on them. Finally, in 1942, Rautenberger condensed his ideas into a short memorandum, and through Martin Bormann, had this version shown directly to Adolf Hitler. Responding favorably, Hitler made a speech to the Reichstag on 26 April 1942. So you see, a few months before, we're in August now, but a few months before this is when this took place, in which he sought and received full power to undertake a complete reform of the judiciary based on Rautenberger's proposed principles. So he liked this guy, and the other one, Terak, is another jurist. So he's talking about this topic the whole time during this dinner. Or is it lunch?
Yeah, right. Midday, yeah. Uh-huh. Crimes big and little. The punishment fits the crime, judges, and the nation's morale. I am not by nature a brutal man. No mercy on traitors. An anti-Semitic Jew, the hero of 100 murders. Legislators and magistrates. The education of judges. The lawyer as a civil servant. I've just read that a man has been sentenced to 3 months imprisonment for having ill-treated an animal. Apparently he kicked a hen which had strayed into his garden. Well, I do not approve. In my opinion, shooting hares is a far greater horror of cruelty. Every sportsman who shoots an animal without killing it should, in my opinion, receive at least a like sentence. The nation must not get the idea that one type of sadist is applauded and the other put in prison. The sportsman shoots game to satisfy his lust for murder. The man who kicked the hen simply did so to guard his garden from damage and had no murderous intention. I know how irritating it can be when a hen gets in your garden and every time you chase it out, back it comes again. When I was a child, my parents had a little garden in Leonding. Our neighbor insisted on letting her hens forage in our garden. One day, I loaded a shotgun and blazed off at them. Since then, I have learned that the legal remedy is for the hens to be confiscated and returned only after damages have been paid. All that palaver over a hen pecking in a neighbor's garden. The case of the persistent poacher who steals a hen is quite different. Here, I would say, his activities constitute an offense against public austerity in time of war. I think justice in cases like these must take motive, which is by no means constant, into consideration. I have had a good deal to do with the law, and I have been behind the bars for quite a time. At Landsberg, the great pundit once told me quite solemnly that he could not make up his mind whether punishment should be administered as revenge, as a means of prevention, or as a method of correction. My retort was that, as far as the man at the receiving end was concerned, it didn't make a damn of difference. Seriously, I do not think one can lay down hard and fast rules in these matters. For example, if some youth of 18 snatches a woman's handbag in peacetime, I would not condemn him to death. Now we're at war. We have the blackout. A large majority of the women have been incorporated into industry, and we are obliged to take severe precautions for their protection. In Berlin, at one time, the criminals became so bold that women did not dare go out alone after dark. If they are not checked, crimes of this sort can develop into an epidemic of rape, robbery, and violence, etc. A timely intervention is therefore very necessary. The spark must be put out before it bursts into flame. Take, for example, the robberies from Sellers. That's C-E-L-L-A-R-S. These are very serious, particularly at a time like this, when we're compelled to break down the walls between the cellars of various dwelling houses. When the thieves begin to take advantage of this state of affairs, we must either take active steps against them or see the whole of our air raid shelter system, and with it the morale of the population, put in jeopardy. One single bomb falling in the midst of a row of houses may cause 2,000 deaths, and the man who risks his life at the front might, with justice, become bitter against a state which expects this sacrifice from him and at the same time does not trouble to safeguard his family at home. Harsh and brutal lines of distinction must therefore be drawn. If a man hits a hen over the head, it's not a crime that is likely to initiate a crime wave. But when some blackguard systematically robs from gardens and takes away the few miserable vegetables the owner is trying to produce, then I say he's a criminal of the most ignominious type, for whom no punishment is too severe. Those sort of crimes must be strangled at birth. Measures must be introduced and must be made clear to all to ensure the repression of any breach of public law and order, and to make certain, too, that the inevitable cheapening of life at the front is not counterbalanced by a proportionate overvaluation of the lives of the less worthy elements on the home front. The morale of a people depends to a large extent on the activity of their judges. Every war gives rise to a species of selectivity in reverse. The finest and fittest perish by the thousand. Even among the brave, the choice of arm of the services constitutes a sort of super selective process, the bravest of the brave going for Air Force and the submarine service. And then in all branches of the service, the call is continual. Who volunteers for, and always, gallant men come forward and die. In time, then, there remains only the rascal, living in peace and security. The man who is sent to prison has the certainty that nothing further can befall him. If this process is allowed to continue for 3 or 4 years, it will upset the whole equilibrium of the nation. Prison is no longer a hardship. On the Volkhov, front men lie not on a bunk, as in prison, but in the icy water, exposed to the winds, sleepless, often without food or hope of relief. A people taken en masse is neither wholly good nor wholly bad. It possesses neither the courage to be wholly admirable nor the wickedness to be wholly evil. It is the extremes at each end of the scale that decide the level of the average. If the good are decimated while the evil are preserved, then it is quite possible, as happened in Germany in 1918, for a handful of a few hundred evil vagabonds to do violence to a whole nation. In Berlin itself, 8 party members fall for every 1 non-party man killed, and unfortunately is always the flower of the party, my SA leaders, my regional and group leaders, who are the first to fall. If I fail to exterminate the vermin as a counterbalance, a dangerous situation would arise. I'm certainly not a brutal man by nature, and consequently, it is cold reason that guides my actions. I have risked my own life 1,000 times, and I owe my preservation simply to my good fortune. I say, therefore, that sentiment must play no part in these matters. We must apply a rule of iron and admit of no exceptions. This may often pain me personally, and it may well lead to errors which one will later regretfully acknowledge. But any other course of action is out of the question. At the end of the First War, I was far more imbued with humanitarian ideals than was our system of justice. Circumstances alter cases. The main thing is to be honest and logical with oneself. Weakness in wartime is not admissible. In the case of a traitor, the amount of damage he has done carries little weight. It's the act itself which counts. There are some crimes which, without any shadow of a doubt, put him who commits them outside the pale of the community. In the Third Reich, no traitor shall commit treason and escape with his life. It is the least we can do for those who have left their homes and wives to do battle at the front. In such matters, I am merciless, and the law should be equally merciless. It should also be capable of appreciating public opinion. As it is, a poacher kills a hare and goes to prison for 3 months. I myself should have taken the fellow and put him into one of the guerrilla companies of the SS. I'm no admirer of the poacher, particularly as I'm a vegetarian, but in him I see the sole element of romance in the so-called sport of shooting. Incidentally, there's no doubt that we number quite a few poachers among the most stalwart adherents of the party. When I say all this, do not imagine that I condone the wholesale depredations of poachers among the wildlife of the forests. On the contrary, my sympathies are entirely with the gamekeepers. It is most interesting to note how wisely a people, from children upwards, react to measures taken in the general interest. If a woman sends her man at the front a parcel, and it is stolen on the way, the primary reaction is, bloody swine, he should be bumped off. That is primitive human instinct. The woman deprived herself of something for her man's sake. This bastard grabbed it from her. Kill him. There's nothing sentimental about that. It's just plain, sane herd instinct. The community at large derives no benefit or support from the inbred degenerates in its midst. It is nevertheless curious to see how these latter, in certain circumstances, react in much the same manner as ordinary people. I know of a comedian, Pallenberg by name, who was a typical Jew intellectual. He salted his money away in a Jew bank in Holland. Now that he has, of course, lost it all, he's violently anti-Semitic. In the case of Seafeld, I told Gertner that if the fellow had really committed 36 murders, it was essential to find out how he had done so. At that moment, only 12 had been proved against him. Gertner was very hesitant, so I suggested that he should allow the Gestapo to try their hand, adding that nothing would happen to the fella, that at the most he would get a good hiding, that I had myself received in one fell swoop all the thrashings I deserved, that had I myself received all those, and I had in my life that I should have had, I should be dead. The net result was that the blackguard confessed to 107 murders, of which Gertner would have remained in ignorance but for the Gestapo. According to his confession, he had employed unique methods of his own. I quote this example to prove that there are cases in which severity is essential. The law is not an end in itself. Its function is to maintain public order, without which there can be neither civilization nor progress. All means used to this end are justifiable. The law must be neither harsh nor lenient, but it must adapt itself to the ends for whose benefit it's been created. The legislator cannot possibly catalog and prescribe for every conceivable crime. When a crime is committed for which no provision at law exists, is the duty of the judge to pass sentence on the merits of the case. For obviously, the absence of a particular crime from the statute book does not presuppose that the legislation intended it to go unpunished. An efficient judge will find the means adequately to punish the criminal and to safeguard the public interest. The body judicial must be recruited from the best elements of the nation. The judge must possess a keen sensitivity which permits him to grasp the intentions of the legislature, to implement them in spirit as in fact, and to amplify them whenever necessary. It is essential that a judge have the clearest possible picture of the intentions of the legislature and the goal which this latter pursues. Admittedly, in peacetime, a leaven of humanitarianism is admissible. The fact that today the executive intervened to some degree in the application of the law must not in any way be regarded as a violation of the judicial prerogative, nor indeed is this intervention in any way intolerable. It is rather an attempt to coordinate the desires of the legislature and the duties of the body judicial, both of whom have the same object in view. But the idea that the judge is there to give absolutely irrevocable judgment, even if the world should come to an end as a result, is nonsense. The judge's primary duty, on the contrary, is to secure law and order for the community. The officers of the law must be the best paid officials of the state, a corps d'élite whose whole education teaches them not to take cover behind the legislature, but to have the courage to act on their own responsibility. This, it might be objected, could be tantamount to turning the law into the handmaid of political power. Not necessarily. The holders of power are themselves subject to the law. No body judicial, conscious of its responsibilities and willing to assume them, will condone a shameful act. But should the government act shamefully, the law is in no position to prevent it. Neither Roman law, the law of the Middle Ages, nor our present code of justice has ever been in a position to do that. If the government of a state is composed of indifferent individuals, then the body judicial can do nothing to correct the mistakes of the legislators. But when the reins are in the hands of an honest and capable legislator, then the law can support him wholeheartedly in his task of strengthening the bonds for national community and of thus laying the ideal foundation on which a healthy and dignified constitution can be built. The task of the judge is a mighty one. He must be as ready to accept responsibility as the legislator himself. He must cooperate with him in the closest possible manner so that together they may protect society from the destructive elements and promote the interests of the community by which such means as the times and the circumstances may from time to time dictate. If this degree of collaboration is achieved, the legislature will find itself relieved of the necessity for ever having to promulgate new laws, and no longer will it feel itself called upon to prescribe exact punishments, ranging from imprisonment to penal servitude and from penal servitude to the death penalty. Its task will be restricted to the drawing up of a general code of justice under which the judge will have the sole responsibility of deciding the appropriate punishment, from simple imprisonment to the death penalty, for the particular crime committed. As things are, when a court condemns to death and at the same time makes a recommendation for mercy, it places me in an embarrassing position. It is not a situation in which the legislature should be called upon to intervene. If the code of justice is sound and the judge is thoroughly conversant with it, then the latter, in a doubtful case, would undoubtedly consult his ministers before passing sentence. There must be the closest collaboration between the state incarnate and the body judicial. Instruction in the law schools must be drastically revised. In my opinion, it is vital that a judge should acquire considerable experience of life before he is called upon to accept the responsibilities of his position. No one, for example, should be appointed as a judge who has not had previous administrative experience in the party. A judge must have profound personal experience of the matters in which he will be called upon to pass judgment. Present conditions offer him no opportunity of acquiring the insight, which is a prerequisite to the successful accomplishment of his duties. Another prerequisite is that he should have a general knowledge of the various activities, industrial and others, of society. I have known a motor car case in which the presiding judge thought that the speedometer was actuated by gas. All he knew about a motor was that somewhere or other water, oil, and petrol had to be put into it. One has no right to expect a sound verdict from a man in such a position. The expert whom he calls in to his assistance may well be some old rogue bent solely on prolonging the period of his employment by abundant use of technical argument and phraseology. To me, it appears very desirable that a host of petty causes should be heard not by a judge de carrier, but by honorary magistrates versed and experienced in the ordinary ways of life. A very large number of minor cases are dealt with in this way within the party, and it should not be difficult to find men endowed with sufficient wisdom to deal with these small causes. I think that the lawyer, as well as the judge, should be a servant of the state. I am quite satisfied that a judge weighs the facts placed before him most conscientiously, and I see no reason why a lawyer, in advising his client as to his best line of defense, should not act in a like manner. I have had considerable experience of the law courts. Two people go to court, they cannot both be right, and the one who has had the better and more well-known lawyer wins his case. The first time I went to court, I thought that lawyers were honorable men. When my lawyer suggested to me that I had been the victim of grievous damage, I, in my innocence, agreed with him. It was only later when I received his account that I realized the consequences of my ready acquiescence. Now, am I not right in saying that he acted dishonestly? I've known cases in which a peasant has been shamefully exploited by the lawyers who squeezed the wretched little man like a lemon to the last available drop. And once that has been extracted, the case ends. Such malpractices must cease. The lawyer of the future, like the judge and the physician, must be a servant of the state. For the whole object of the law is to arrive at the truth. I once had a lawyer who was so timid that within 48 hours I had the feeling that I was the defendant, not the plaintiff. The worst feature of the legal system is trial by jury. Formerly, this was regarded as the ideal. And up to 1918, I myself regarded the jury in a case as men apart. As a matter of fact, at that time, I held all officials, I think, in similar respect. I reminded myself that my father was a man of honor, a chairman of the Assizes and a Justizrat. I had no idea that a Justizrat is a private individual who makes his living by defending scoundrels. On one occasion, I was called as a witness in a case against an army deserter, a first-class swine named Sauper. The Justizrat rose and asked me a few questions, to which, like a silly fool, I answered quite frankly, "You have just returned from the front. You have, I see, a wound stripe and the insignia of the Iron Cross First Class. What is your opinion of this deserter?" I told him in unmistakable terms what I thought of the swine. The Justizrat smiled. "I object to this witness on the score of personal prejudice," he declared solemnly. The objection was upheld, and the filthy Sauper got off scot-free. When the case ended, an officer who was in the public gallery came up to me with outstretched hand. "For God's sake, let's get out of here," he cried. I have a reputation for driving very slowly through built-up areas. One day, my chauffeur received a summons for having driven through a village near Nuremberg at an excessive speed. I attended the court personally, and the following little dialogue took place. The judge: "But, Herr Hitler, what is your object in defending this case?" Myself: "I am objecting because it is not true that we were doing more than 30 kilometers an hour." The judge: "In this court, everyone charged with exceeding the speed limit is invariably fined. I'm sorry, but I'm afraid I can make no exception in your particular case." I had engaged a lawyer recommended to me by the insurance company to which our association paid thousands of marks yearly. To save the man trouble, I drove him to and from the court in my own car. Thanks to him, the court fine was reduced from 30 to 10 marks. And 3 weeks later, I received a bill from him for over 400. The same jurist should, in my opinion, be available for duty as either a judge or an advocate. And I think he's meaning here a prosecutor or a defender. As a state servant, he can fulfill both roles. He should have the right at law, when defending an incorrigible criminal, to plead extenuating circumstances, but not to defend his innocence with the oratory of an angel. Very far-reaching reforms are required in our judicial system, but they must be introduced gradually and concurrently with the gradual reorganization of the whole legal profession. And that's that very lengthy session on Hitler's tirade against the court system, the silly rulings, the injustices, the actual criminality of lawyers, and the lack of qualification of most jurists and judges with enough common sense to see that justice is done in cases.
Wow,
see, a whole
right.
lot of what, you know, you
really
know, a whole lot of what
he
said.
Yes. I'm kind of amazed that old Heinrich Heine wrote so much of it, but he did.
Yes.
And I imagine that some of these jurists said something here and there, and Hitler was responding I don't think he was just going on this long, very long soliloquy here. I imagine that there were some comments by these jurists, and then he picked up, but Haim only copied down what he said, what Hitler said. So, but it's, boy, there's a just really interesting. I just think there's some of the things he says are just fantastic, and the whole thing is very interesting. But here's something, though, where he said that he used to think that lawyers were honorable men, and then he had experience with lawyers, and he realized they weren't. So now he's saying that he thinks the lawyers of the future must be a servant of the state, just like the judges and so on, that they should all be employed by the state. Now, that's very controversial. If you have a really good state, you know, really well run, that would work. But otherwise, it could be very corrupted. But the private attorneys, he's right, the way they function. And again, it's all about money. I mean, the value system. If in the jury system, everything is according to how much money it costs or how much money there is, and so on. And in the National Socialists, it's about what's good for the whole community and everybody.
Yeah.
So it's just such a different point of view that people couldn't say, well, what Hitler's saying here, oh, that'd be terrible, you know, oh, my God, what's he wants everything to be done by the government. Well,
You know, I had to think about this one incident just as I did a while ago about that black market items. And you started to hear yourself a minute ago when you said about lawyers being honorable men. He had once thought that. Right before that, he says two people go to court. The one who has had the better and more well-known lawyer wins his case. In other words, money talks. And then he says, when my lawyer suggested to me that I had been the victim of grievous damage, I, in my innocence, agreed with him. Now, what I'm thinking here is that Hitler must have gone to court over some fairly trivial matter or felt like maybe he had been done a wrong by somebody, and he just wanted to see things straightened out and justice done. And this lawyer jumps in and says, oh, man, I can do something with this case. I can get you so many marks or whatever, you know, saying you've really been the victim of grievous damage. Well, that probably shocked Hitler, and so he's thinking, well, this guy knows the law, and so he said, I, in my innocence, agreed with him. Well, yes, I have suffered this big deal, and actually it was probably not that big a deal, but it seemed to him like this lawyer was going to get him something for nothing or, you know, whatever. And then he said it was only later that he realized the consequences of my ready acquiescence, and he said, now, am I not right in saying that he acted dishonestly? Sure he did, misleading a client, making something, you know, that it wasn't there. So, It was a very telling a section right here. And
then
go right ahead. Go right ahead.
Well, and then that other lawyer for the speeding ticket, he got his fine down from 30 to 10 marks.
Yes.
And then he charged him 400 marks for his legal fee. Wow, that gives you a big lesson, doesn't it? I bet he didn't pay it all. I would hope not. But that's dishonest. Knowing that you're only saving the guy $20, but that you're going to charge him $400 for doing it, that's really criminal.
Yeah, and, you know, another line, the last thing he has that judge saying here was also telling. You know, Hitler's there defending and saying, hey, this is not true that we were doing more than 30 kilometers an hour. It's not true. Mm-hmm. Well, the judge turns around and tells him, well, in my court, everybody charged with exceeding the speed limit is invariably fined, whether you're guilty or not, you know? And he says, I'm sorry, but I can't make any exception for you. So, bam, 30 marks. And then he says, well, at least my lawyer got it reduced to 10, but then turned around and charged
him. But, yeah, then he went out and got a lawyer. Maybe he went out and got a lawyer at that point because it made him mad.
Yeah.
But then he ended up screwed. So
yeah, that's right.
You have to be careful with lawyers.
It's no wonder
and the law.
All throughout this book, we've been exposed to Hitler's views on the legal profession and what he thinks of attorneys. And And it really comes home in these little examples in this section right here. I really did like that.
Yeah, and he's obviously already done some work on reform, and this fellow Rottenberger, was it, had all these ideas, and Hitler liked them. And now that it's some months later, but he's talking, he's there visiting, he says he wants to do a whole lot more. So he really wanted to work on the legal profession in Germany. But
yeah.
Obviously, I don't know what he would have ended up doing because he didn't get a chance to do it. Well, what have we got here? Oh, we got another long one. I don't think we can do this one.
It's about three pages. We wouldn't get through with it. Still. Okay.
So, but I guess I talked too much in the beginning, but we didn't get very far tonight.
No, on the contrary. On the contrary, I think that we got further than we've been getting page-wise in the book. And I just want to tell you, I really am pleased because we've been covering 10 and 11 pages in the last three or four shows.
Oh,
and tonight we covered 14. I had kind of looked at tonight's show and I thought, okay, the first section we cover is 4.5 pages. And then there's a little half a page shorty, which makes 5. And then this section we just finished on the judicial stuff was 9 pages. So I thought, well, I hope we get through that.
And then
nine
we had
page
the
deal,
crimes against animals. Oh, no, that's the one we just did. That's this one.
Yeah, we just did that. That was 9 pages itself.
There's 3 more down here that we didn't get to. Well, I won't have to figure them out next week. I'll have them already.
Okay, but we covered from page in the book, Carolyn, from page 631 to 645.
Yeah.
And the book ends on page 722. So that gives you an idea. We've got 70-something pages to go.
Not much.
To finish up. And, you know, so that's 6 or 7 weeks maybe at the most. I figured April 16th or 23rd we should wrap it up. You know, it's rolling along now.
Well, it is, and I think that the subjects tonight were so interesting and needed to be discussed a little bit. So
I
hope that it was interesting for all the listeners. And I'm ready to say goodnight. How about you, Ray?
All right, I'll go along with that. I appreciate folks that were listening this evening, and I enjoyed the program myself, Carolyn, and we shall see you all on March the 12th.
And you know what? We had a lot of live listeners, relatively speaking, last week.
Wonderful.
I don't know how many we have tonight. I don't know what brought all those people on live. Maybe because I'm taking too long posting the show afterwards, but we'll see if we have more, if we have a larger audience tonight. But okay, so you already said goodnight. I say goodnight too, ladies and gentlemen. This has been Table Talk, Hitler's Table Talk with Carolyn and Ray every Thursday night. See you next week.